Hi, it's Patrick Hutzel again from intensivecarehotline.com. This is the second part of our video about 7 questions you need to ask the most senior doctor, most senior physician, or most senior consultant if your loved one is critically ill in intensive care. So we continue on here from the first video and we now start again with question number 3. And the question is, how do you know, or how do you expect to know, how my critically ill loved one's quality of life is going to be after their stay in intensive care? This is a tricky question, and you need to ask this question to the most senior doctor in intensive care anyway, because people have different views about quality of life. The reality also is that ICU doctors and nurses are extremely poor at judging what a patient's perceived quality of life is going to be once they leave intensive care. Why do I say this? I say this because intensive care health professionals are like fish in water, and they live and breathe intensive care, and they're usually very good at what they do in intensive care. Take them out of ICU and they are lost. They wouldn't have a clue. Intensive care units are designed to treat critically ill people, and they're very good at it. What they are not good at is to say, okay, your mother has been admitted to intensive care with multiple injuries, therefore we think and believe that in six months' time she will have no quality of life or this quality of life. It's a perception, and I think it's just a whole lot of rubbish. Intensive care units deal with high acuity patients with the main goal of survival and stabilization. As soon as a patient leaves intensive care, the ICU team generally has no idea what's happening from there. Now, given that hospital mortality is around 10%, meaning that 10 out of 100 hospital admissions are actually dying, and the intensive care mortality is around 6 to 8%, meaning 6 to 8 out of 100 ICU admissions are dying, we have no idea in intensive care about what is happening to patients after they have left intensive care. Therefore, the intensive care doctors and nurses should not make too many predictions and judgments about a patient's future quality of life and their perception of it. Judgments and perceptions of quality of life after intensive care are often based on the realities in intensive care. And because of the very nature of the intensive care environment, those views can be distorted. Furthermore, because of the lack of quality of life for patients in intensive care, doctors and nurses often think that the severity of the critical illness might lead to future lack of quality of life for patients and their families. I have seen this over and over again. The judgment about future quality of life and perceived quality of life from an intensive care doctor and nursing point of view is just that. It's a perceived future. I also believe it's a very premature judgment. Whether that's true and real or not is unclear, and once again, intensive care health professionals tend to have no clue as to what is happening outside of intensive care. And given that the majority of patients who leave intensive care do not come back, it means that they can't do all that bad, can they? So, you need to ask this question not only to the most senior consultant in intensive care, but also ask the nurses, and most importantly, ask yourself, ask your family, and if your critically ill loved one in intensive care is conscious and can make his or her own decisions, ask him or her. Don't presume that health professionals in intensive care know everything, or even, quote unquote, know what's best. They know pretty much everything in intensive care, but we all have blind spots, and theirs is what's happening outside of intensive care. What's really important for you and for your family to know in the discussions around perceived quality of life is that often a withdrawal of treatment, a limitation of treatment, or a not for resuscitation order may be justified by the medical staff in intensive care with a perceived outlook of poor quality of life. This, from my perspective, is a very limiting mindset, and I personally don't think that it's good to have a limiting mindset. Would a more abundant mindset help in such discussions about perceived quality of life? Intensive care is a very challenging, volatile, and often highly charged environment, and therefore people working in the environment, doctors and nurses in particular, can be stressed and they can be overwhelmed by complexity, by dealing with death, and by dealing with critical illness. It comes with the territory. I do therefore think that sometimes decision making is dependent on those complexities, and just like you and your family, health professionals in intensive care can be frustrated at times as well. They may have had a bad run with several deaths in the last few days. They may have had people calling in sick today, putting more pressure and a higher workload on the remaining people and staff. Once again, as I mentioned before, it's not all black and white in intensive care, and your job is to always read between the lines. Also, read our other free resources on our blog to give you a better understanding how quality of life and also perceived quality of life and the discussions and the justifications around it may impact on your thinking and on your judgment just as much as it impacts on the intensive care team's thinking and judgment. As a side note to quality of life and perceived quality of life, in some countries, mainly in the US, Canada, Australia, and in some European countries like Germany, Austria, and Switzerland, some thoughtful intensive care professionals have taken the quality of life issue for long-term ventilated adults and children with tracheostomy in intensive care to another level, and they have started to look outside of the box by offering intensive home care services for those patients, by providing those patients and their families with a much better quality of life despite their limitations. Those models of intensive home care are massively successful and provide a genuine alternative to a long-term stay in intensive care. You can find more information at intensivecareathome.com.au. Some of the resources in particular might also help you to clarify any misconceptions you may have about quality of life inside and outside of intensive care. I have written a few more ebooks about this issue, and one of the ebooks and also videos that I shot about it is Follow This Proven System to Avoid the Three Most Dangerous Mistakes That You Are Making But You Are Unaware Of If Your Loved One Is a Critically Ill Patient in Intensive Care. Avoid these mistakes and you can exercise more control and gain influence fast in an environment where other people are in control. The other ebook and video is Follow This Proven System to Avoid the Three Most Dangerous Mistakes You Are Making But You Are Unaware Of If Your Loved One Is a Long-Term Ventilated Patient with Tracheostomy in Intensive Care. And the other book or video that I shot about the issue is 10 Things Doctors and Nurses Are Talking About If Your Loved One Is Critically Ill in Intensive Care When You Are Not Present at the Bedside. So go and get these resources on our product page and have a closer look at quality of life issues and the discussions around it, as well as many other topics in intensive care that will put you directly in control so that you have power and influence as well while your loved one is critically ill in intensive care. Next question that you need to ask the intensive care doctor whilst your loved one is critically ill in intensive care, and this is question number 4. How does other patients awaiting admission to intensive care impact on my critically ill loved one's prognosis? This is an interesting and very important question, and one you need to definitely ask your most senior doctor, most senior physician, and most senior consultant in intensive care. This particular question, as well as question number 1, how does the intensive care unit's budget impact on my critically ill loved one's stay in intensive care, connect with each other? You always need to keep in mind that intensive care units have a very high demand on beds. And all intensive care units usually have one thing in common, that they usually have a very high demand on their beds and therefore a high demand on their resources. I have rarely seen that beds in intensive care stay empty for longer than 24 to 48 hours, meaning one patient goes out and one patient comes in. Some intensive care units even have to defer admissions or delay admissions and direct them to other hospitals due to a lack of resources, which may mean lack of beds or sometimes lack of staff or sometimes lack of both. Many first world countries, including the United Kingdom and Australia, have waiting lists in hospitals for elective surgery due to a lack of resources. Some patients on those waiting lists would require an intensive care bed after their surgery, which is one of the reasons why they are on a waiting list. There is a very fine line between what can be done and what is actually done in reality. I have touched on issues in intensive care regarding end of life, regarding quality of life, regarding withdrawal or limitation of treatment, amongst other significant ethical and moral issues and dilemmas in intensive care. There is often a fine line between what can be done and what is done in reality. This fine line is very often invisible for families of critically ill patients in intensive care and is only visible to insiders and to people who know and understand intensive care inside out. One of those fine lines regarding decision making and perceptions about your critically ill loved one's prognosis, perceived future quality of life, etc., often play out in the dynamics in intensive care. It might actually happen right in front of the doorstep of ICU, often in the operating theater, in the emergency room or emergency department, or even out on the road with paramedics and ambulances picking up patients. What if your critically ill loved one has a relatively poor prognosis and is 84 years of age? What if at the same time there are two more admissions waiting to come to intensive care? Could there be pressure on beds? What if the intensive care team knows that in the next few days the pressure on beds is going to be high due to a predicted high activity in the operating theater or operating room? What if the intensive care team knows that some of the admissions coming to intensive care are significantly younger than your 84-year-old critically ill loved one? You also know that your 84-year-old critically ill loved one wants to live and wouldn't give up lightly. With your previous knowledge about what you have discovered about intensive care and the realities about it thus far, you know now and understand the implications of limited resources. With that knowledge in mind, I can't stress enough that intensive care units have finite resources, and the allocation of those finite resources is really what matters. Clinical or hospital realities and prognosis do matter, but your knowledge, your input, and your level of control, power, and influence matter just as much. If you are positioning yourself correctly, and if you keep asking the right questions. In order for you to have maximum input, maximum control, and maximum influence in those decisions, you need to have a heightened awareness what the realities are in intensive care and how decision makers think and on what realities they base their thinking and ultimately their decision making, besides the clinical realities and besides your critically ill loved one's prognosis and diagnosis. So, let's move on to the next question you need to ask the most senior doctor in intensive care. This is question number 5. Is it possible that you are giving me and my family a poor or negative prognosis for my critically ill loved one in case things don't go well, so that you can protect your professional reputation? Maybe you have figured this one out already. If not, or if you are unsure, let me shed more light on it. Let's say that your critically ill loved one is 80 years of age and has just had a car accident with multiple rib fractures and multiple bone fractures, including their pelvis or hip, but thank God your critically ill loved one has no head injuries. Your critically ill loved one's situation is, well, very critical. Given your critically ill loved one's age and the nature of their injuries, they appear to be very frail and fragile and very slow on their way to recovery. However, given that your critically ill loved one has no head injury and no heart problems, your loved ones will recover. Your loved one's recovery will be slow, but he or she will recover. This doesn't necessarily mean that the intensive care doctors will tell you so. Of course, there's always a risk of complications and setbacks in intensive care generally. However, there is a tendency that the intensive care medical team will paint a rather negative picture towards the recovery of your critically ill loved one. Some of the reasons why some of the intensive care doctors may have a more negative outlook I have touched on in question number one and questions number four. But there is also, of course, their professional reputation at stake. If they promise you that your critically ill loved one is going to fully recover and then isn't, you might actually hold them accountable and you might question their professional judgment to the point where you may consider suing them. If things go much better as predicted, even better, and you might see them in a more favorable light. Here's a quick tip. Try and ask the nurses. They are usually more than happy to give you their genuine opinion about your critically ill loved one's prognosis for a number of reasons, including that they are probably less worried about their professional reputation and they're more concerned about honesty. Question number six. If my critically ill loved one is going to approach their end of life, in what time frame do you expect this to happen? Can we ensure that he or she has a dignified death, and can he or she have a private room and a peaceful death with family and friends around? So, if you and your family are in the situation where your critically ill loved one in intensive care is approaching their end of life, and you and your family have accepted that this is the way it is, and it is sad, but you are also certain that the intensive care team has done the best they could possibly do in order to save your critically ill loved one's life, your next question might be about the timing of the end-of-life situation for your loved one. Depending on your critically ill loved one's circumstances and depending on how much life support he or she is getting, you should be able to negotiate the timing of the end-of-life situation with the intensive care team. The goal in those negotiations should be your and your family's or friends' comfort and wishes, as well as your loved one's comfort and wishes, so that you had the chance to say goodbye, and you also might want to ensure that certain cultural, religious, or spiritual needs that are appropriate for you and for your loved one have been addressed and fulfilled before you and your family are ready to let your loved one go. One of the main reasons why I want to bring this to your attention is that I have seen very unfortunate and very inconsiderate circumstances more than once where intensive care patients have approached their end of life in less than optimal circumstances, where families were pushed to let their loved one die at a specific time before actually some important family members or friends had arrived, or before certain cultural, religious, or spiritual needs had been addressed. It leaves a very bad taste for everybody involved, including the doctors and the nurses. It's almost like a cloud hanging over the intensive care unit. Everybody can feel it, including other patients and their families. The reasons for pushing families to let their loved one die earlier than they wanted to? You guessed it. Limited resources. The intensive care team wanted the bed for the next patient. Do never let the intensive care team push you. It's your loved one and not theirs. Do things on your terms, and you are on your way to learn to do it your way. There are very few hard and fast rules and guidelines about end-of-life situations in intensive care. However, I believe that certain issues and wishes need to be addressed in an end-of-life situation, and if they are not openly discussed and addressed, and the reality is that they are often not openly discussed, prior to your loved one dying, you and your family might have bad memories for the rest of your life. You also also might want to think about asking for a private room in the ICU, depending on the layout and depending on open or closed bed spaces in the intensive care unit. I do strongly believe, and I also know from experience, that a private room tends to be better for everyone involved in the end-of-life situation. Imagine your loved one is dying in the middle of an open and busy unit with very little privacy and very little dignity. Some intensive care units think ahead and offer your loved one a private room, however sometimes you need to ask for it. Don't be shy to ask. If you don't ask, you don't get. I have said this in other ebooks and videos of our report and video series. I have been involved in many end-of-life situations in intensive care, and I do strongly believe that dealing with an end-of-life situation is a privilege if the situation is handled well and due consideration has been given to the family and their loved one's needs. If the situation is handled poorly, it leaves a bad taste in everybody's mouth. Some intensive care units are very good at dealing with end-of-life situations, but others aren't. Therefore, it's your job to control what you can control and ask for what you think you need in your circumstances. There are some very unfortunate circumstances where you can't time or plan end-of-life situations, but if you can, you need to do so, period. It's in the best interest for everyone. It's bad enough that you are losing your critically ill loved one in intensive care, and if you need to let your loved one go, make sure you remember it is a good death, and make sure you do it on your terms as much as you can. Question number 7. If you and the intensive care team want to or suggest to limit treatment, or withdraw life support on my critically ill loved one, are there any conflicting interests that you as a senior consultant, physician, and or the intensive care team has because you are doing research on some patients that meet certain criteria and you don't want to continue treatment on my critically ill loved one because my critically ill loved one doesn't meet those research criteria for your research paper and for your research thesis? Now, this is an extremely powerful question to ask, because if you do ask that question, your level of power, your level of control, and your level of influence will immediately skyrocket and go through the roof. Now, the intensive care team and the most senior doctor or most senior consultant in intensive care has no interest whatsoever to let you look into the interests, the dynamics, and the research that is constantly going on in a busy intensive care unit. And you must also know that millions of dollars or millions of pounds go into clinical research in intensive care. I have seen research that would blow your mind, and yet universities, even government-funded departments of health, throw money at some intensive care units and intensive care consultants to publish a research paper where they conduct research at a time where your critically ill loved one is most vulnerable. It's of massive interest for an intensive care unit and for a senior consultant or physician in intensive care to have their name published on a research paper, because that will open other doors, including money for more research. Another benefit senior consultants or physicians get is benefits from pharmaceutical companies, because a lot of research is done with drugs and medications. Often research will be commenced from the minute your critically ill loved one has entered intensive care, and when you first meet the intensive care team, they might throw in a comment along the lines of, "Oh, by the way, we've enrolled your critically ill loved one into this study about blood transfusions or about ventilation or about this new drug, and that they are trialing," and the list could go on about research. Because generally speaking, you and your family are so overwhelmed, so freaked out, stressed, challenged, and out of your comfort zone that you hardly pay any attention of these sort of things. All that generally matters to you and your family is the well-being of your critically ill loved one, and somebody mentioning research hardly enters your mind. I'll give you a couple of examples so that you know what's going on in the name of medicine and how it could impact on your critically ill loved one. One of the research studies that I have seen over the many years that nearly blew my mind was that a patient was ready to be taken off the ventilator and was out of the induced coma, and the family of this patient was asked by the intensive care team to put their loved one back in an induced coma and then wake him up again and take him off the ventilator then. The family was gobsmacked, and so was I, and they said to the intensive care team that they will think about it and get back to them. I was the nurse looking after this patient, and the family asked me what I thought, and I told them not to agree to putting their loved one back into an induced coma. The longer a patient is on a ventilator, the higher the risk that they won't get off the ventilator. Another situation I witnessed over the many years in intensive care was a particularly cruel one, where a young man with a head injury was enrolled in a study for cooling or hypothermia for head injuries, as the theory was that cooling the body and also the brain after head injuries suggested better long-term outcomes. The young man was cooled and hypothermic for about 3 days, and on his third day he ended up having deranged clotting of his blood. The blood was getting too thin and caused another bleed in his head, which was basically his ultimate fate and caused him to die. Now, don't get me wrong, head injuries are challenging at the best of times. However, doing research on extremely vulnerable people is, from my perspective, just plain wrong and highly questionable from an ethical and a moral point of view. The reality, however, is that there is a million-dollar industry attached to it. The young man's prognosis was very poor from the start. However, doing research on such vulnerable people is ethically and morally extremely questionable as far as I'm concerned. To bring it back to the initial question that you must ask the most senior doctor, consultant or physician in intensive care about conflicting interests regarding their research and a possible withdrawal or limitation of life support, you must know this. If a critically ill patient fits a certain criteria to do research on them, and even though their prognosis might be poor, the intensive care team will most likely continue treating that patient, allocate resources towards this patient, and for the sake of the research paper and research thesis. On the other hand, if your critically ill loved one doesn't fit the criteria for research that the intensive care team or the most senior doctor, consultant or physician is doing, the intensive care team may tell you that a withdrawal of treatment, a limitation of treatment or a withdrawal of life support might be, quote unquote, in the best interest of your critically ill loved one. Well, in most instances, nothing could be further from the truth, and that's why it's so important to ask the right questions that get you on the path to control, power, and influence. Now, as I promised, here is our last question, and it's your bonus question. The bonus question goes like this: if my loved one is going to die, is there a possibility that he or she can die at home? I do think, and I do strongly believe, that this is a big one. It's highly underrated. That's why I included it as a bonus question for you to consider. In over more than 14 years of intensive care nursing, I have seen many critically ill patients and nursed them at the end of their lives, and once again, in most instances, it was a tremendous privilege. There aren't many jobs or professions in this world who have the privilege to look after people and their families at the end of their life. As I have said in previous reports or ebooks, I'm a big believer that death is a part of life, and that the sooner we accept it as a fact, the better off we are as a community of people. I also believe that people want to die at home if given a real choice. If we would be more accepting of the fact that death is part of life, we might also be more accepting of the fact that a lot of people do actually want to approach the end of life at home if given a choice, according to some very recent surveys. Now, as a nurse in intensive care, I have also seen numerous families asking the doctors and the nurses in intensive care whether their loved one could die at home. And in fact, one thing most of them have in common is the statement of, how much nicer would it be if our loved one could die at home in peace? Or another common statement that I hear over and over again is just plain and simple, can't we take our loved one home? Unfortunately, most intensive care units don't think that this is even an option as yet. Health professionals don't think outside of their clinical realms as yet. Very few intensive care units usually have an extension of their services outside of intensive care, and they also don't want to upset the status quo for a number of reasons. Some, but very few ICUs that I know of, happen to offer to take patients out of intensive care to their home and let them approach their end of life in their own homes. There is no doubt about it that this can be done. People need to have the right skill set, but it's far more important that they have the right mindset. I also think that home equals peace of mind. Also, keeping in mind that not even 100 years ago, there were 3 to 4 generations all living under one roof, with babies being born and people dying under the same roof, it was just natural. So, if you feel like you and your family would have more peace of mind, more control, more influence, and also wish to let your loved one die at home, why not ask? You never know. Maybe the hospital can arrange something. Maybe there is an external service provider. Besides my work in intensive care, I have also worked in the community providing specialized home intensive care nursing for long-term ventilated adults and children with tracheostomy, and I have personally been involved in looking after ventilated adults and children who approach their end of life at home as well. It was a very good experience, and I have found that families who have a loved one approaching their end of life at home tend to have a lot more peace of mind and control, of course. If you happen to live in Australia, for example, there is one designated intensive home care nursing service specialized in taking long-term ventilated adults and children with tracheostomy out of intensive care, and they also specialize on quality of end-of-life services for ventilated adults and children out of intensive care. Check out intensivecareathome.com.au for more information. For more information on a variety of topics within intensive care, check out more of our reports, ebooks and videos, and also read our blog for more tips and strategies, and also check out our Your Questions Answered section. Find the links in the written version of this video. You can also send me an email to support@intensivecarehotline.com if you have any more questions. Thank you again for watching this video, and I'm sure this video has even given you more insight and knowledge so that you have control, power and influence whilst your loved one is critically ill in intensive care. Thank you for watching this video, and I'll see you again in another video. This is Patrick Hutzel from intensivecarehotline.com.